Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. A new Texas nonprofit led by Donald Trump's grown sons is offering access to the freshly minted president during inauguration weekend, all in exchange for a $1 million donation to unnamed conservation charities, according to interviews and documents reviewed by the Center for Public Integrity. Prospective $1 million donors to the opening day 2017 event, slated for January 21st, the day after inauguration, at Washington, D.C.'s Walter E. Washington Convention Center, receive a private reception and photo opportunity for 16 guests with President Donald J. Trump, a multi-day hunting and/or fishing excursion for 4 guests with Donald Trump Jr. and/or Eric Trump and team, as well as tickets to other events and autographed guitars by an opening day 2017 performer. TMZ.com first published a brochure hyping the happening. The brochure says that all net proceeds from the opening day event will be donated to conservation charities, but it doesn't name the charities or detail how net proceeds will be calculated. Who's behind the get-together? Walter Kinsey, chief executive officer of Texas event management company Encore Live, confirmed to the Center for Public Integrity that a nonprofit group called the Opening Day Foundation hired his firm to manage Opening Day 2017. A Center for Public Integrity review of Texas incorporation records found the Opening Day Foundation was created less than a week ago, on December 14th. Unlike political committees, such nonprofits aren't required by law to reveal their donors, allowing sponsors to write 7-figure checks for access to the president while staying anonymous if they choose. The paperwork for the Opening Day Foundation listed 4 directors, Donald Trump Jr., Eric Trump, Dallas investor Gentry Beach, and Tom Hicks Jr., the son of a Dallas billionaire. Beach and Hicks are reportedly close friends with Donald Trump Jr., and both men helped raise millions of dollars for Trump's campaign. The event is being put on by the Opening Day Foundation, Kinsey confirmed, adding, "There are a number of different individuals who are part of the foundation." Kinsey also said the information in the brochure posted by TMZ.com was not entirely accurate. He did not specify what was incorrect, and he added that the participation of the Trump family is not confirmed. The Trump Organization, a spokeswoman for President-elect Trump, and the presidential transition team did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Hicks and Beach also did not immediately respond to phone messages requesting comment. The brochure for Opening Day 2017, an event described as Honoring President Donald J. Trump, offers sponsor packages ranging from $25,000 to $1 million. The event will celebrate the great American tradition of outdoor sporting, shooting, fishing, and conservation, the brochure states. Mike Ingram, an Arizona developer who is listed as one of the co-chairmen, said Beach approached him to help. "I'm honored to do it," he said. "It's not going to be a black tie event. It's going to be boots and jeans and camouflage, and it's going to raise a lot of money to go to sportsmen's charities and conservation charities," he said. Ingram said he could not confirm the Trump family's participation. "This is problematic on so many levels," said Larry Noble, the general counsel of the Campaign Legal Center, a nonpartisan campaign reform organization. "This is Donald Trump and the Trump family using a brand new organization to raise $1 million contributions for a vague goal of giving money to conservation charities, which seems a way of basically just selling influence and selling the ability to meet with the president." Noble cautioned that the details of the event and its association with the new nonprofit listing the Trump brothers as directors are still unclear. "It's really hard to identify all the problems when they're so vague," he said. The Trump family has recently endured criticism for appearing to sell access to Trump's adult children, who serve on the executive committee of Trump's presidential transition team and have functioned as key advisors since he began his campaign. The family canceled an auction for coffee with Trump's daughter, Ivanka Trump, last week after ethics experts said it was ethically questionable, according to the New York Times. The proceeds of the auction would have gone to the Eric Trump Foundation, an existing nonprofit whose mission is to support a children's hospital. This article was posted by Carrie Levine and is from the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit, nonpartisan investigative media organization in Washington, D.C.
Iconic fashion designer Calvin Klein says he'd dress incoming First Lady Melania Trump. "Of course I would," Klein, who donated to Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential bid, said when asked by a TMZ reporter outside the restaurant Catch. But just as Klein expressed his support for dressing Trump, Christian Siriano, who dressed Trump for the 2010 Met Ball and wavered on the question in the past, firmly said he doesn't plan to dress her. "At this time, what Melania and her world represents, I just don't think represents. We don't share the same values and the same things as a lot of designers, especially a lot of young gay designers feel," Siriano told Bustle. "It's very hard to support people that don't support you, which has only been a thing. I'm not supporting anybody who doesn't support me, so that's my biggest thing. So we'll see how the 4 years go." Klein and Siriano are the latest designers to chime in on whether they'll make clothes for the next First Lady, as the fashion industry overwhelmingly supported Clinton over President-elect Donald Trump. Sophie Thielette, Tom Ford, and Marc Jacobs have placed themselves firmly in the no camp, while Tommy Hilfiger, Diane von Furstenberg, and Tom Brown have said that they'll dress Trump. This article was posted by Samantha Cooney. Gone are the days when parents gifted teachers with shiny red apples. Now, some 1% parents are shelling out, sometimes against their better judgment, for lavish holiday gifts like Rolex watches, gift cards for plastic surgery, and Hermes scarves, the New York Post reported. However, some parents aren't giving generous gifts out of the goodness of their hearts, according to an early childhood educator named Sarah. "Most teachers at my school expect a nice gift, and if they don't get it, they remember who did and who didn't give," she told the Post. Over the years, Sarah herself has received a $250 gift card to pricey Brooklyn steakhouse Peter Luger and a Michael Kors watch valued at $500. One plastic surgeon on the Upper East Side told the Post his office sells about a dozen gift cards, with values ranging from $2,500 to $5,000 for teachers. Other parents told the Post that they're tipping their children's teachers generously simply out of fear of retribution. "If teachers don't get tips, they get resentful," said Leah, a mother of two from Brooklyn. The expectation of over-the-top gifting has annoyed those who already shell out tens of thousands each year in tuition. Lauren, a Lower East Side mom, told the Post she was forced to chip in $100 to buy her 2-year-old's teacher an Hermes scarf, typically $400 to $1,000. "I would never buy that scarf for myself," Lauren said. She's not the only outraged parent. Heather Graben, a mom of a 4-year-old in Jersey City, New Jersey, was angered to receive an email from her daughter's preschool asking for holiday tips for teachers. "I think they're trying to palm holding gifts off on the parents," Graben told the Post. "They should treat their employees just like Goldman Sachs does. If you do your job well, you'll get a bonus." Other parents, however, see the gifts as making up for teachers' low salaries. "These poor teachers, how much do they make a year? $50,000? These poor people," Laura, an Upper East Side mother, said to the Post. This article was posted by Carrie Close. For decades, historians have debated who betrayed Anne Frank and her family. After spending 2 years eluding Nazi capture while in hiding in Amsterdam, the Frank family was discovered on August 4, 1944, and promptly deported from the Netherlands to concentration camps. Years later, after Anne Frank became famous for her diary, readers wondered what had gone wrong. A long-held theory proposed that a new employee at her father's business, Willem van Maren, tipped off the Nazis. But despite suspicions, there was no conclusive evidence van Maren betrayed the family. Now, about 72 years later, the world may have an answer to the mystery. Maybe nobody betrayed them at all. Last week, the Anne Frank House Museum in Amsterdam released a study that suggests that Anne Frank and the seven others hiding with her were discovered by chance. According to the researchers, the German Sicherheitsdienst police who discovered the family usually investigated cases involving cash and securities, not Jews in hiding. On August 4, 1944, they went to investigate 263 Prenzengracht, the same building where Anne and her family were hiding, after receiving tips of fraudulent food ration cards and illegal employment happening there. When they came to raid the building, they unexpectedly discovered Anne and the others. The research is based on Frank's diary entries from March 1944, entries that researchers say have not been used as a source until now. Her writing created a trail to judicial documents from other parts of the Netherlands, resulting in the latest theory. Despite decades of research, betrayal as a point of departure has delivered nothing conclusive, Ronald Leopold, executive director of the Anne Frank House Museum, said in statement. The new investigation does not refute the possibility that the people in hiding were betrayed, but illustrates that other scenarios should also be considered. Anne, who is famous for documenting her time in the secret annex in her renowned diary, died of typhus in the spring of 1945 at the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp in Germany. She was 15 at the time of her death. Out of the seven others who hid with her, her father, Otto Frank, was the only one who survived the Holocaust. This article was posted by Madeline Farber. Like all presidential candidates, Donald Trump made a lot of campaign promises. Though enough voters appear to have liked what they heard to make Trump president, some of those pledges, like deporting millions of illegal immigrants and banning Muslims from entering the country, are unlikely ever to be fulfilled. Here, then, are five of the most significant recent promises being made by politicians around the world, and what they tell us about current conditions in the countries they lead. 1. Angela Merkel, Germany. The promise. The full veil is not appropriate for us, and should be banned wherever legally possible. What it says about Germany. Merkel remains committed to the Western liberal order. Having grown up in East Germany, she has seen the alternative firsthand. But her vow to accept as many Syrian refugees, more than a million to date, as qualify under German asylum rules has, however well-intentioned, created an easily measured political backlash across the country. Facing elections next fall, she has seen her approval rating drop from more than 70% in the summer of 2015 to 55% today. She remains the odds-on favorite to remain chancellor, but the trend lines have her attention and her concern. The promise to ban full face covering for Muslim women represents an attempt to take the edge off the anger of those who blame Merkel for allowing too many Muslims to enter the country, even if the legally possible clause gives her some wiggle room. Ever the scientist, Merkel understands the idea, often attributed to Charles Darwin, that it's not the strongest or smartest who survive. It's the most capable of adapting to their environment. Bloomberg, Wall Street Journal, CBS News. 2. Hassan Rouhani, Iran. The promise. Tehran will not let Donald Trump tear up the Iran nuclear deal. What it says about Iran. President Rouhani, also facing re-election, is in an even tougher spot. In Iran, he's the face of a nuclear deal with the West that has not delivered the sudden economic boost he promised. Iran expected its economy to expand by 8%, but the IMF says it's grown by just 4.5%. Enter Donald Trump, who matches the inflammatory rhetoric of Iran's hardliners with his own condemnation of the deal. Ahead of elections in May, those hardliners think Trump is the greatest thing that could have happened this year. But Rouhani is not wrong about the nuclear deal. Trump knows that other signatories, particularly Russia and China, won't reimpose sanctions on Iran just because Washington wants them to. Rouhani has real leverage here. But his aggressive rhetoric on this subject reflects the anxiety of Iran's reformers that hardline rivals are gaining political ground on them. 3. Narendra Modi, India. The promise. I promise to deliver a corruption-free India. People have chosen our government to get rid of black money. What it says about India. In early November, Modi surprised his country by announcing that 500 and 1,000 rupee notes, equivalent to $7.50 and $15 respectively, would no longer be accepted as legal tender. This touched off nationwide protests. India is a cash-based economy, and those 500 and 1,000 rupee notes make up 86% of the total money in circulation. But Modi framed the move as a necessary evil to tackle tax evasion. According to 2013 figures, only 1% of Indians paid taxes, and he knows that corruption is a problem that plagues every level of India's economy. To date, India is one of globalization's biggest winners. Between 2004 to 2011, the number of Indians living on less than $1.90 a day fell from 433 million to 268 million. But having a lot of cash doesn't make a country developed. It needs institutions that have substantial influence in the real economy. In particular, it needs the ability to collect taxes. Since 2014, Modi has advanced a number of much-needed reforms that didn't require congressional cooperation, but he needs his party to win in provincial elections next year ahead of his 2028 re-election campaign to give him the mandate he'll need to move forward on tougher reforms. 4. Theresa May, United Kingdom. The promise. We want to bring net migration down to sustainable levels. That means in the tens of thousands. When we leave the European Union, we will be able to bring control to the movement of people from the EU into the United Kingdom. What it says about the UK. 6 months later, and British leaders are still wondering what Brexit means Brexit really means. We know that immigration control, which 33% of Leave voters cited as their main motivation for voting, has become the public focal point of the Theresa May administration. That makes sense for a country whose foreign-born population has doubled since 1993 as a direct result of EU rules on the movement of people. But for all of May's tough talk, it remains to be seen whether the UK will surrender all access to Europe's single market to gain closer to full control of its borders. Brussels has balked at this suggestion. The benefits of trade with the EU come with respect for EU values, like the free movement of people across borders. Given that there are more than 1 million UK citizens living in other EU countries, and more than 3 million EU citizens living in the UK, eventual compromise remains a good bet. But in the meantime, both sides will protect their domestic political strength by appearing to drive as hard a bargain as possible. 5. Xi Jinping, China and Hong Kong. The promise. Beginning in 2017, Hong Kong gets to elect its chief executive by popular vote, but Beijing gets to vet which candidates are allowed to stand. What it says about China. China's president, Xi Jinping, continues to consolidate power. The 1 million-plus Communist Party members punished during his anti-corruption push can attest to that. But Xi knows that as China's international influence expands, he must protect his country's international image. Pro-democracy activism in Hong Kong can make Beijing's life miserable, especially ahead of a crucial leadership transition in China itself next fall. Beijing wants to create the appearance of democracy in Hong Kong without losing control of its politics. It can crush dissent in Tibet or Xinjiang without much international media coverage. In Hong Kong, there are cameras everywhere, and the so-called umbrella movement knows how to play them. 5 of 7 members of the Politburo Standing Committee, the country's highest political authority, are scheduled to be replaced, though Xi will stay on to serve for a second 5-year term. Not a good moment for a public test of Xi's strength. This article was posted by Ian Bremmer.
How you feel about Garth Jennings and Christoph Lordelais's animated jukebox musical Sing depends less on your tolerance for watching animals warble, roar, and croon pop songs for nearly 2 hours, and who doesn't love that, than on your patience for pinball machine story mechanics and hyper-self-aware adorableness. Matthew McConaughey provides the voice of showbiz impresario, theater owner, and koala Buster Moon, whose business is failing thanks to too many clunkers. He decides that a talent contest is the way to bring in bucks, so he announces one, offering a $1,000 prize, money he barely has. His elderly secretary, Miss Crawley, Garth Jennings, a shuffling lizard with an ill-fitting glass eye, she also happens to be the movie's best major character, mistypes the amount on the advertising flyers, increasing it 100-fold. Scores of animals show up for the big audition, and this is the picture's finest scene, energetic without being exhausting. A water buffalo Barry White's his way through Crazy Town's butterfly. A snail in a bow tie clings to the mic as he shimmies to Christopher Cross' Ride Like the Wind. Sadly, those two fine performers don't make Buster's cut, and after they're axed, Singh demands that we shift our attention to the actual finalists and the workaday problems they face when they're not singing. Rosita, Reese Witherspoon, is a beleaguered, piggy homemaker and mom with an unappreciative husband, Nick Offerman, and too many little piggies to look after. Ash, Scarlett Johansson, is a punky, spunky porcupine in a plaid mini-kilt who's suffering through a breakup with a bad boyfriend. Mike, Seth MacFarlane, is a slick Sinatra-esque mouse with a rat-sized gambling debt. Mina, Tori Kelly, is an elephant with self-confidence issues, and so on. Singh is the latest from Illumination Entertainment, which also brought us The Double Bummers, The Secret Life of Pets, and Minions. This movie suffers from almost exactly the same problems as those two do. It jumps around from song to song and from plot point to plot point, unable to trust in the attention spans of modern children or even just modern human beings. The color scheme is bright and cheerful, the fur and scales and eyes of the animals look super realistic, and a few of the musical numbers are mildly rousing. The best may be Rosita's rendering of Taylor Swift's No Flies on Me anthem Shake It Off. She's joined by Nick Kroll, who voices the character of her song and dance partner, a porker in a tight, spangly jumpsuit named Gunter. But Singh, like its yearning for validation characters, mostly just radiates desperation. Plus, the snail should have won. This article posted by Stephanie Zacharick. 60 years into the world's longest civil war, the transition to peaceful democracy in Myanmar remains elusive. The UN recently reported that up to 30,000 Muslims had fled their homes amid reignited violence in Myanmar's Rakhine State. It is the latest and largest exodus since the bitter sectarian conflict in 2012 that left scores dead and pushed over 120,000 into camps where they remain today. Long considered a pariah state under the rule of a military junta, Myanmar has seen remarkable political progress. It has been 1 year since the country's first openly contested elections, accompanied by a sweeping reform and national reconciliation agenda with the country's 15 ethnic armed groups and 135 recognized ethnic minorities, won by Nobel laureate and human rights icon Aung San Suu Kyi, elevating hopes for a new and strategic democratic partner in Asia. But the threat posed by the country's persistent humanitarian and political challenges remains significant. Support is needed now for Myanmar to remain a beacon of hope in the region. The cauldron of decades-old ethnic strife has been boiling in Myanmar in recent weeks across northern Shan, Rakhine, Karen, and Kachin, adding to the 1 million already in need of urgent humanitarian assistance across the country. Aid to Rakhine, already one of Myanmar's poorest states, has been suspended for over a month at the time of writing, where reliance thereon is already near absolute as Muslim communities continue to face severe restrictions on their rights, only exacerbating an already critical humanitarian crisis. A comprehensive peace process is indispensable to an inclusive, stronger union for all of Myanmar's constituents, and consistent diplomatic engagement is necessary, which includes the recently formed Advisory Commission on Rakhine led by Kofi Annan. But the urgent alleviation of the country's humanitarian challenges is equally indispensable for a durable peace, and the international community has a strong role to play. 3 points are vital. First, Myanmar urgently needs a boost in immediate assistance to meet humanitarian need across communities and across conflict-affected areas. With a rosier political outlook, donors have indeed been quick to declare success in Myanmar, and much-needed and already scarce funding has dried up as a result. Despite ongoing waves of displacement across the country, the UN appeal is critically underfunded, a request of a mere $191 million just over halfway met. More aid is indispensable to meeting Myanmar's growing and long-standing humanitarian need, additionally boosting much-needed economic development in restive states. Myanmar also is in need of long-term and flexible approaches, not just quick fixes, to address both peaks in humanitarian need and much-needed development. The International Rescue Committee's Project for Local Empowerment is such an example. For the past 5 years, the program has been working through a network of 37 ethnically led, community-based organizations to provide cash, food, protection, health, and education relief to 500,000 conflict-affected people on both sides of the Thailand-Myanmar border. Most important, the PLE brings ethnic service providers together with their government counterparts in order to pave a peaceful path for longer-term development, weaving the fabric of increased and comprehensive services for all of Myanmar's constituents. Second, greater, more strategic aid is only as good as whom it reaches. As the conflict between the Burmese military and ethnic armed groups across the country reignites, access remains severely restricted to humanitarian actors, aggravating critical need and putting ongoing relief efforts at risk. All parties to conflict in Myanmar and across its conflict-affected states, in accordance with international humanitarian law, must allow full, immediate, and unimpeded delivery of impartial assistance for civilians, preventing a deterioration in humanitarian conditions and a continued strain on durable peace. The safe and comprehensive reintegration of Myanmar's future constituents is the third critical factor. Myanmar's 1 million refugees and internally displaced persons who derive principally from the country's minority population have yet to be convinced that the political environment and their prospects for the future have changed. A significant improvement in the rights, protections, and services afforded to all of Myanmar's citizens is the pull factor that will bring them home. Conversely, a premature return process not preceded by serious change in these domains will only further fracture the state. The Burmese government, its neighbors, and international actors must work together to ensure that returns are safe, voluntary, and informed, and preceded by a concerted boost in the reach and scale of basic services and job opportunities back home. Meeting humanitarian need is as much an end in itself as a strategic imperative in Myanmar. The challenges before one of Asia's newest democracies are many, pressing, and daunting. But the true success of Myanmar's democratic quest hinges on the resolution of its protracted displacement crisis and persistent humanitarian challenges, themselves an expression of the pivotal need to provide full and equal rights, protections, and services to the country's constituents, regardless of ethnicity, religion, or gender. Only then can the promise of a prosperous, inclusive democracy in Myanmar and an end to the world's longest civil war finally rise from rhetoric to reality. This article posted by David Miliband. David Miliband is President and CEO of the International Rescue Committee and former British Foreign Secretary. Russia's ambassador to Turkey was shot dead in Ankara on Monday by a police officer who shouted, "Don't forget Aleppo, don't forget Syria," in an attack that will unsettle the sensitive diplomacy over the regional crisis emanating from the civil war in Syria. The shooting comes at a moment of high-stakes negotiations between Turkey and Russia, with implications for the future of the Syrian conflict, which has left as many as 500,000 people dead. Russia condemned the killing as an act of terrorism. Ambassador Andrei Karlov was shot at an art gallery in the Turkish capital on Monday. In video footage, the ambassador stands at a podium as gunfire rings out. He flinches and then drops to the floor. Standing behind him, a man holding a gun and wearing a dark suit and tie raises one finger skyward and shouts, "Allahu Akbar," an Arabic expression meaning "God is great." The gunman continues speaking, "Don't forget Aleppo, don't forget Syria," he shouts in Turkish. "As long as our cities are unsafe, you will not be safe," he also says. "Everyone who has a role in this cruelty will pay for it." Turkey's Interior Minister Süleyman Soylu identified the attacker was a 22-year-old police officer named Mevlüt Mert Altintas. Russian and Turkish leaders stressed that the assassination would not result in renewed hostility between the two countries. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called the killing an unquestionable provocation to damage Turkish-Russian bilateral relations. He said that he and Russian President Vladimir Putin are on the same page on this issue. There is no controversy. Putin echoed his Turkish counterpart, saying in televised remarks, "This murder is clearly a provocation aimed at undermining the improvement and normalization of Russian-Turkish relations, as well as undermining the peace process in Syria." Russia's support for the regime of Syrian President Bashar Assad has angered sections of the public in Turkey, where the government supports Syrian rebel groups fighting Assad. Over the last several days, angry demonstrations took place outside Russia's diplomatic missions in Turkey, denouncing the heavy Russian bombardment of the rebel-held section of the city of Aleppo. The assassination took place on the eve of a diplomatic summit in Moscow, including the foreign ministers of Russia and Iran, a meeting of key regional powers that back opposing sides in the Syrian war. Russian and Turkish officials confirmed that the meeting will proceed as planned. Last week, Turkey and Russia negotiated an agreement to evacuate the remaining civilians and rebel fighters from a besieged enclave in the city of Aleppo, marking a victory for the Assad government and a turning point in more than 5.5 years of crisis. The Turkish and Russian governments recently set aside tensions following a period of deep discord. Turkey shot down a Russian warplane that crossed into its airspace along the Syrian border in November 2015, triggering months of hostility in which Russia imposed sanctions on Turkey. Putin and Erdogan reached a rapprochement in June, and Turkey hosted the Russian leader at an energy summit in Istanbul in September. Russian Foreign Ministry spokesman Maria Zakharova called the assassination a terrorist attack. According to Russia's TASS news agency, she said Russia was in contact with Turkish officials who had pledged an all-around investigation into the shooting. "The attackers will be punished," she said. This article posted by Jared Malzin. There's no doubt that 2016 was Riz Ahmed's breakout year. The 34-year-old actor recently earned a Golden Globe nomination for his role on HBO's The Night Of and starred alongside Matt Damon in this summer's Jason Bourne. Ahmed also raps as Riz MC and can be heard on the new Hamilton mixtape. But on December 16th, he'll appear in his biggest project to date, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. During a recent interview with Time, Ahmed revealed how he snagged the role of pilot Bodhi Rook after director Gareth Edwards compared him to an infamous character from Apocalypse Now. Time: how did you come to be cast in the film? Ahmed: Gareth Edwards comes from a background of British independent movies, which is where I've done the majority of my work up to this point. He reached out and said, "There's this role. It's not fully developed." He made some interesting references to Dennis Hopper in Apocalypse Now, and he asked me to go on tape. He made the mistake of giving me his email address because I just spammed him about 10 to 15 different versions of this thing, doing this obsessive thing that I do. And he emailed me back at one point like, "Hey, Riz, you don't need to keep emailing me your audition. You're good. We'll get back to you." And I was like, "Oh, man, I screwed it up." But I got the part. In an essay published in The Guardian, you wrote about three stages of typecasting for ethnic minorities in film. Stage one is the two-dimensional stereotype, the cab driver or terrorist. Stage two challenges those stereotypes. Stage three, a character whose story is not intrinsically linked to race. What stage is Bodhi? I've mostly evaded typecasting as an actor. The characters I've played have all been very, very different characters. I made a decision not to play characters that were reinforcing stereotypes with two-dimensional portrayals. I hope the work that I've done forces the culture to stretch a bit. And my agenda here isn't some kind of niche specialist cause. It's really the same agenda that I hope every actor, writer, director, painter, and musician has, which is to contribute in some small way to stretching our collective empathy as a society. I think that films like Star Wars are great at letting so many different people put themselves in someone else's shoes, and there are so many different pairs to try on. Daisy Ridley's shoes, or John Boyega's, or mine, or Donnie Yen's, or Felicity Jones's, or Diego Luna's. The cast is very international. What was it like on set having so many people from so many different countries? There was a lot of Google Translate going on. No, I'm kidding. I love languages, actually, so I just took it as an opportunity to learn random catchphrases. I can swear in lots of different languages now. That's the upshot. This article posted by Eliana Doctorman. A fragile ceasefire was back on in Syria on Monday as buses resumed evacuating those still remaining in eastern Aleppo following days of delays, and others departed with the sick and wounded from two rebel-besieged Shiite villages in the country's north. At the United Nations, the Security Council was expected to vote within hours on a resolution seeking to deploy UN monitors to Aleppo immediately in order to prevent what France has warned could be mass atrocities by Syrian forces and allied pro-government militias as they assume control of all of the rebel enclave. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights and the Pan-Arab Al-Mayadeen TV said that 10 buses left with civilians from the two Shiite villages long besieged by rebels, Fua and Kafaria, and were on their way to government-controlled areas on Monday. According to the deal, more than 2,000 sick and wounded are supposed to leave the villages. The observatory and the Pan-Arab TV said 15 additional buses entered the two villages to bring out more people. The evacuations from the villages were added on as conditions to a Turkey and Russia-brokered ceasefire deal that paved way for the last rebels and civilians to leave the remainder of the rebel enclave in the eastern half of Aleppo. The departure from the villages had stalled on Sunday after militants burned 6 empty buses assigned to take the villagers out. On the Aleppo front, the observatory reported shortly before midnight Sunday that government forces have allowed 5 buses to leave from the last sliver of rebel territory in the east of the city. Al-Mayadeen aired live footage from Aleppo, showing buses it said were carrying opposition fighters and civilians heading west toward rebel-held parts of the Aleppo province. If the evacuation from Aleppo is completed later on Monday, it will close another chapter in Syria's civil war, now in its 6th year, with rebels having no remaining presence in Syria's largest city and the country's once commercial center. The rebels captured eastern Aleppo in July 2012 and held onto it despite a ferocious assault in the past weeks by Syrian government forces backed by Russia and a host of Shiite militias from Iraq, Lebanon, Iran, and Afghanistan. The capture of the entire city would be President Bashar Assad's biggest victory since the Syrian conflict began in March 2011. Observatory's chief Rami Abdurrahman said he expected Aleppo evacuations to be completed sometime on Monday. He said the evacuations will happen in 3 phases. First, 1,250 people from Fua and Kafaria will leave in return for the government allowing half of the people still in eastern Aleppo to head to rebel-held parts of the country. Then another 1,250 people will leave from the two Shiite villages in exchange for the departure of all remaining civilians and opposition fighters in eastern Aleppo. The third phase will include 1,500 people living from Fuwa and Kaffaria, and in return, 1,500 people will be allowed to leave two besieged rebel-held towns, Madaya and Zabadani, near the Lebanon border. At the United Nations, the compromise text of the resolution calls for the United Nations and other institutions to monitor the evacuations and demands that UN Chief Ban Ki-moon urgently consult all parties on the immediate deployment of the monitors. France and Russia, who submitted rival draft resolutions, struck a compromise text after more than 3 hours of closed-door consultations by the UN Security Council on Sunday. The draft text also demands that all parties allow unconditional and immediate access for the UN and its partners to deliver humanitarian aid and medical care and respect and protect all civilians across Aleppo and throughout Syria. France's UN Ambassador François Delattre, who expressed hope that the new resolution will be approved, said the goal is to avoid a new Srebrenica, a reference to the massacre of nearly 8,000 Bosnian Muslims who sought protection in the UN safe haven of Srebrenica in 1995 during the Bosnian War. U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power said 100-plus U.N. personnel are ready to monitor evacuations once there is a green light. She said following the siege of eastern Aleppo, there have been many, many reports of people being pulled off buses and disappeared, whether into conscription or into torture chambers or killed outright. The UN doesn't know because it's not there, Power said, but if monitors are deployed, it could deter some of the worst excesses. This article posted by Bassem Rue for the Associated Press at the United Nations. Associated Press writer Edith M. Lederer at the United Nations contributed to this report. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.